Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is award-winning composer, inventor, and technologist, Shelley Palmer. But let's start here. The RIAA releases revenue figures for the U.S. in 2023, and on the surface, the numbers look great. The market grew by almost 8%, and it's up 17% from its peak in the CD era in 1999. But the report also spotted some trends the music industry should be worried about. One trend is that the U.S. market is very reliant on paid subscriptions, and that's almost 60% of the revenue that's generated. What's interesting here is that just 10 years ago, industry pundits predicted that we would never have so many subscribers, and yet here we are. Problem is that the music subscription market has peaked. 50% of U.S. internet users now subscribe to a music streaming plan. Yeah, there's still room for some growth, but the market is staring at a plateau that's coming in just a few years. So how about those subscribers in the free music streaming tiers? These are supported by advertising, but here again, the advertising spend is slowing down as it barely increased over 2022. So how about social media? This includes platforms like TikTok, but there's actually not much money coming in from them. In fact, the recent boycott by Universal Music on TikTok is looking more and more like a stalemate, and only the artists are losing. The bottom line is not to expect an increase in revenue here either. So that brings us to physical sales like vinyl records and CDs and even cassettes. There's some growth here, but it's only about 15% of the overall music business. No one expects this portion of the business to grow much, although they do expect it to be a steady source of revenue in the coming years. What this all means is that the revenue level that we're at now might be as good as it gets unless a new, higher-priced form of music delivery is created. If listeners get subscription fatigue and start to eliminate streaming services, the music industry better hope that music is the very last one of them to cut. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that the fifth edition of my Recording Engineer's Handbook is now available. It's totally updated and includes new sections on the latest cutting-edge recording technology, multiple ways to mic over 70 different instruments, a new chapter on recording immersive audio, new hitmaker engineer interviews, and much more. To get your copy, go to rebrand.ly/recording-handbook. That's rebrand.ly/recording-handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. And remember, you can learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. My guest this week is Shelley Palmer, who's an award-winning composer, inventor, author, educator, and a leading voice in technology. He's also an expert in AI and its integration into the workplace. Shelley began his career as a composer for television, working with hundreds of brands, agencies, broadcasters, publishers, and tech platforms on advertising and marketing campaigns such as Meowmix, Burger King, and the City of Las Vegas. He's been honored by ASCAP in the category of most performed television themes. Shelley also holds a patent for the underlying technology for enhanced television that's used by programs such as ABC's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and ESPN's Monday Night Football, which led him to pivot his career into technology. He's currently a professor of advanced media in residence at Syracuse University's S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications and the CEO of the Palmer Group, a consulting practice that helps Fortune 500 companies with technology, media, and marketing. Shelley also covers tech and business for Fox 5 New York and is a regular commentator for CNN and CNBC, and he offers a series of free technology courses via his Meta Academy. During an interview, we spoke about growing up in a music store, how a used synthesizer got him into the jingle business, how one of his patents took him into the world of technology, why AI is a skills amplifier, and so much more. I spoke with Shelley from a studio in New York City. Tell me about your early days and getting into music. Before we even get to the tech stuff, I want to hear about you and music.
Well, mom and dad met at Juilliard. They owned music stores. They were both music educators in the New York City school system when they got married. They worked in Bed-Stuy. And the story goes, the family story goes, that they could not afford daycare. on the teacher salaries. So when I was born, what they did was with a couple of their friends, they, of course, I was too young to know this, but the family story goes that with a couple of their friends, they got a storefront and they created an after school music studio that they could teach private lessons and run programs in. And my earliest memory is being in a playpen in this middle of this room, and all around with these rooms with closed doors with different sounds from different instruments, piano and guitar and flute and saxophone and clarinet and trumpet, just all in different practice rooms as they were all taking lessons. All these people were taking lessons. My very earliest memory of my life is just, and I kind of see it in a funny way. I sort of see it in a, like a drone shot as opposed to like where I was. It's just a really strange memory. My father did confirm that that is exactly what they did with me. So that was pretty funny. So anyway, they own music stores. Ultimately, they actually opened music stores. And, you know, many kids earn their allowances by mowing lawns. I earned my allowances by tuning guitars and dusting them. There were hundreds of guitars in the store, and my Saturdays were spent tuning them and then dusting off things that were in display cases and pianos. But I had to make sure that all the guitars were tuned, you know, because people would come in and play them and to buy them. So that was how I earned my allowance when I was little. I just remember that. And I also remember Walter, the guitar and amplifier repair guy, and loving his workbench. And there was a big wood shop in the back. They repaired brass and woodwind instruments. And I really liked that too. That was like great fun. So my early days were spent, you know, mom and dad would play a lot. My mother's a piano player. Dad was a trumpet player, played decent piano, was more of a conductor and arranger. And so that's what my early childhood was about. It was just playing constantly different instruments and woodwinds, percussion, keyboard. There was some kind of jam session happening in my house every night. Didn't matter what you played. There was a big music room. There's plenty of things to play. Sit at the drums or sit at the piano or pick up a horn and just play. I wasn't a brass player, just woodwinds. But it was great fun growing up in that environment, and a lot of singing, a lot of music. It was kind of funny too, because it was a transitional period. I grew up in the, I guess you'd call it late 60s, early 70s, you know, that kind of era. So the transition from 50s rock and roll had really already happened. The Beatles had already invaded. The Rolling Stones are already real. When I was, you know, aware of pop music, my parents, to them, pop music was Broadway. And to me, pop music was the Beatles and the Stones and, you know, whatever things my parents considered the devil's music. It was like fantastic. So there was a fairly significant dichotomy of interests. And then my dad had an immense lacquer record collection, Sidney Bechet, Tommy Dorsey, Benny Goodman, you know, all of the big band shellac records, a 78 shellac records, lacquer records from the 40s. And he would play them on a regular basis. And as I was learning to play, he put up a Sidney Bechet record. He put up a Benny Goodman record. He goes, "Can you do that?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't think so." I mean, you know, and like trying to make that happen. And so my earliest teachers were my parents, but then he got me a bunch of other teachers. And then ultimately, there was pretty decent stereo systems in the house since we sold them in the music store. We kind of brought some good stuff home and had a fairly good size, a fairly serious recording studio in the house. No one will remember the TIAC 40-4 and the 80-8 and the, you know, the first commercial prosumer 8-tracks and 4-tracks. We had all that stuff. And it was a passion of mine to just work in the recording arts. I was very fortunate to meet Les Paul really early in my life.
Wow.
Because he would show up at NAMM conventions. They still have NAMM conventions to this day, the National Association of Music Merchants. It's a different show than it was when I was a kid. When I was a kid, there were a million independent music stores, and you know, now there's just big chains and what have you, and you know, it's sort of a different business. But when I was a kid, we'd go to NAMM, and Buddy Rich would be playing, and Stan Kenton would be there, and you know, there'd be all these incredible. Maynard Ferguson would show up, you know, and each one of these guys was sponsored by somebody.
Yeah.
So you met Chick Corea sitting in the Yamaha booth. You meet Buddy Rich. I think he was Slingerland or Ludwig. I don't remember which drum company he was. Big with, but you would just go and all these guys would be there in these booths, iconic, you know, I mean, legendary. Even when I was a kid, I knew, you know, one of the funniest moments of my life, truly funniest moments of my life, was I was in the Selmer Buffet booth, which is a clarinet maker, saxophone maker. They make the Selmer Mark VI saxophone and they make the Buffet clarinet. And a couple of really, really serious, serious big band guys sat down. And this like jam session naturally evolved. Ultimately, Buddy Rich himself sits down at the drums. I didn't really know who he was at the time because I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And I'm just trying to like, you know, play this clarinet. And I know a lot of songs because that was something my dad was into, a lot of songs. I knew pretty much the whole real book, the whole Great American Songbook, you know, all the standards that my dad loved because that's what he liked to play. Yeah. So that's what I got to hear. And it was this really insane like hour that I didn't think anything about until I learned later in my life who was actually there. And it was nuts. You know, Marvin Stamm is playing trumpet and Lou Sol. The craziest, I'm not even drop names, the craziest group of people you'd ever imagine. And like, that's the kind of stuff you don't know it's happening in your life when it's happening. But I had a very rich musical upbringing. And then I rebelled. And my dad wanted me to go to business school. And I want to go to music school. And I got scholarships to Berkeley and North Texas State, where I really wanted to go. Leon Breeden was the band director there. And they had this thing called the 1 o'clock lab band, which is like the super top of the line, like when I was a kid, jazz band, you know, classic, you know, four trumpets, four trombones, five saxophones, a rhythm section, like big band. And I just wanted to go there. I just wanted to be with those people playing that music. My dad was like, you already know how to play music. Go learn business. We own music stores. We own a lot of music stores. We got warehouses. We got mail order. We got all this stuff going on. And you need to learn how to like run this thing. And I'm like, all I really want to do is learn how to play saxophone better. But I lost that battle. I went off to business school for a minute. I rebelled and went to NYU. Well, I left and I went to NYU film school. And I had a little brief stint at marine biology just to really mess with everybody's head because I like to scuba. So I actually went to like enroll in a community college as a marine biologist so I could scuba dive for like a whole, like a two semesters. My father lost his mind. But then I figured I'll play weekends. I'm working on the weekends. I'm playing music and I'll dive during the week, a couple days a week they were laying the transatlantic cable off of Babylon, New York, Bayshore rather. And it was like, go work on that. But then the guy told me that like, he asked me what I was going to do on disability. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, mostly everybody, you know, gets disabled within about a year here. And what would your plans be after commercial diving? I'm like, well, what kind of injuries is this? Well, punctured eardrums. I'm like, hey, peace out.
Yeah.
So right. I was literally out of the recruiting office within 10 minutes. Didn't happen. So went off to film school at NYU. Really the greatest experience of my educational life. What an incredible place to go. Haig Menugian, may he rest in peace, was running the place. And he trained guys like Woody Allen and Marty Brest and Marty Scorsese and Chris Columbus. Like Haig was a baller. And just being around this guy made you just better at everything. Like everything made you better at making movies, cutting movies, editing sound. Didn't matter what you did, you were better because this guy was around. It was what a unique talent. Anyway, I'm going to film school. I get all these opportunities to all this stuff through the school. And not the least of which was become a student member of the Academy of Television, National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, which I ended up being president of eventually. The nice people to bring you the Emmy Awards. That was sort of amazing that I had started in school. But the most interesting part of that was I didn't know if I was going to go off to AFI. I got sponsored by Marty Brest and Marty Scorsese to go to AFI. So I thought that was going to be cool. And I was like ready to go. And I got offered an opportunity to become the East Coast DGA trainee in my at the same time. And I was like, do I stay on the East Coast and like go become like go on film sets and do like the real thing with the real people? Or they go to school for 2 years. Back then, AFI, you'd take a year of TV and then a year of film, and then they'd let you out into the wild. I was in LA and I was in New York. So all of this is going through my head. Out of nowhere, I'm reading the New York Times. Remember when they used to have classified ads 1 million years ago? Yeah, yeah, right. So at the time, I had a really robust electronic music business. And when I was the first, my dad got me in the union when I was 12 years old. I was the first member in the union listed as a synthesizer player.
Wow.
So I got my first synthesizer literally in 1970. It was a Moog System 2E. serial number 002, pretty early in the game.
Wow.
And it was an amazing instrument. And really, it's hard to describe today what I felt like having been brought up with acoustic musical instruments, parents who were classically, not only classically trained, but classical music educators who, like, to them, again, pop music was like Broadway. And all of a sudden, somebody comes into the music store and demonstrates an analog synthesizer. And I was 12 years old. I lost my mind. I'd never heard anything like it before. You know, the music concrete, maybe a couple of records, but nothing. The theremin was out, but no one had ever, like, with a keyboard, with something you could play and do. And like, said to my dad, we had to buy it. It was so much money. And he was like, it's never going to sell. And he was right. Never did. Cause I grabbed both of those things. I took it right home and it never left the house. I mean, I immediately took it home. Within a year, I figured out how to computer control the potentiometers, and I rigged the whole thing up with a Motorola 6502 and a bunch of processors, little integrated circuit versions of the VCAs, VCFs, and the amplifiers, the oscillators, and the filters, and just sort of rebuilt the thing. And I didn't know how to do it. I just, Walter and I figured out, the guitar and amplifier repair guy. Yeah. I just bought a bunch of parts at Radio Shack and a couple books. And he said, how are we going to do this? I said, I don't know, but I got a couple books. We're going to go. And we just kept doing it till I got it right. So that's where I started my tech education. Anyway, so I'm reading the paper. I'm playing out all over the place and I've got a bunch of gear. And, you know, now it's years later, right? You know, I'm almost, I guess I'm 18, 19 years old, almost 20, I guess. So I was a year and a half ahead in school. And, I see this ad in the paper for an ARP Odyssey, which at the time was ARP's answer to the Mini Moog. And it was a small, self-contained little animal that you could do a lot of things with. Anyway.
I owned one.
Did you?
Yes,
yeah,
I did.
They were awesome. So anyway, I think it was $400 that the guy wanted in the paper. And I was like, okay, you know, they're like $1,200 if you buy them for real. And even wholesale, like $800-$900. It's like, all right, I got to go get this thing. What shape is it? So it's at 80 West 40th Street. I'll never forget the address because I walk in there and who is standing there but Don Elliott. Now, if you don't know that name, Don Elliott was not only a jingle giant at the time, but one of the greatest jazz musicians that was living on the earth. He'd won downbeat jazz polls for vocals and like for vibraphone and also mellophone, which is like a French horn with valves, like a really weird instrument you don't see very often, like 15 years in a row. And I knew this guy from like his recordings but I mean, I never met him, but I walked in there, it was clear as day, like, that's Don Elliott. I'm in his studio. It's like, oh my God, this is so cool. So I walk in there and there's an ARP 2600. And then there's a Korg, I'm going to say SH-1000. And I could have this wrong, but I think it was an SH-1000, a complete toy, like literally color coded knob switches and a small little keyboard and just a toy and sitting next to it. And I see the Odyssey and I walk up to it and I said, you don't mind if I just try it out? I want to make sure it's like you're selling it for like a really reasonable price and I'm happy to pay the money, but I just want to make sure it works. And he goes, yeah, it's fine. So I plug in the amplifier, I just run it through his paces. And Don says to me, you really know this thing. And I said, yeah, I'm not sure why you're selling it, man. It's a great shape. It's a great axe. He's like, well, I only need to do this like Star Wars stuff. You know, R2-D2 thing is really good now. And I said, oh, sample and hold. Yeah. He goes, the SH-1000 does it, like, and he presses the sample and hold switch, and I'm like, yeah, but that only has one setting, and it's a toy. You want to talk? He said, UBC-3PO, I'll be R2-D2, go. And he starts, you know, quoting lines from Star Wars, and I start making those R2-D2 sounds on the Odyssey, and he goes, oh, my God, you really know this stuff. I'm like, well, you know, it's like, I don't know why, if you really need the R2-D2 thing, you really need to have this. The SH-1000 is just like a little weird sample and hold, like, trick. This is... You have complete control over it. I said, but anyway, thanks so much. It's great to meet you. By the way, I'm a big fan. And I go to give him the $400 in cash. And he says, it's not for sale. I'm like, what? He goes, it's not for sale. And I'm like, but he goes, no, I got a better offer for you. A, you're going to be a writer rep for me. I'm paying you $100 a week starting today. And you're going to make phone calls, 100 phone calls a day. And anything you bring in, you get to write demos on. Oh, and tomorrow morning, you're going to earn this. I said, I got class tomorrow morning. He goes, no, you don't. He's like, tomorrow you're going to be an electric lady. We're doing a BMW commercial and you're going to play synth for me on this date. And he gave me the address of Electric Lady, which I did not know. I'd only ever heard of. I'd never been in. I'd never, you know, I mean, for God's sake, it's like, really? And the next morning, I went to Electric Lady and I sat down and I played this date. It was a Mercedes-Benz commercial, actually. And at the end of the date, he paid me scale and gave me the axe.
Wow.
To take home in a case. Like, you know, like I'm like, Donnie, sure. He goes, yeah, this is the address of the office. Be there tomorrow morning. I'm like, I'm still in school. He goes, I don't care. You'll work that out. So that got me in the music business, and that ended the AFI thing, and it ended the DGA. I was like, oh my God, I'm working for Don Elliott. It was absolutely slave wages. I mean, it was like working for free. It's like paying him. I mean, $100 even back then, in I think that was 78, because I wasn't out of school yet. I graduated in 79. Like, even in 78, that was like, that wasn't enough money to take the subway, you know, back and forth. And I couldn't, you know, if you added train fare to my house on Long Island and the rest of it, like, there was no way I could afford to take that job. But it was amazing. So I worked for Don for a couple of years, and then, you know, we parted ways and I started my own company. And so that was the start of my own jingle company. And that's, I started doing that. We moved it to the city in 82. In 86, we opened up Creative Audio Recording Services, where we, in April of that year, we put the very first ever fully tapeless recording studio online. And we did for Bobby Smallheiser at First Edition Editorial, we did that post-production mix. It was a BMW spot, and it was the first ever completely tapeless audio post-production mix laid back to 1-inch video and used on the air. It was quite a remarkable day that no one would ever commemorate or know about, but it was the culmination of years of research and an immense amount of investment in both time and money, and probably was everyone at New England Digital, everyone at my own company, everyone, the people at Yamaha, Bell Labs, like everybody had pitched in to try and make this thing, you know, awesome. And it was an awesome day. And it was the beginning of an era. I mean, it's very much like today in that, because there was a giant lull. Today, every day I go to work, I feel like I'm inventing the future with my team. And back then, every day we went to work, we felt like we were inventing the future. Like, there was something that we wanted to do, something. We heard it in our heads. We saw it in our mind's eye. We thought about it, and there was no way to do it. So we had to invent how to do it. And that's what it feels like today. But like, there was a 20-year period in the middle of my career where it was just do business as usual. Like, the tools are the tools, just do business. But now, like then, it's like a super exciting time. So my musical background, you know, I wrote a lot of music. I really did. And my career shifted right around 2000, 99, 2000. The Walt Disney Company came knocking. They wanted to buy that technology patent that's on the wall behind me. And I didn't want to sell it because I was really thinking about reducing it to practice. I had several patents and I liked this one. They liked it too. They liked it so much they wanted to buy it. And they convinced me, as only Disney can, to sell it to them. But it came with a great set of perks. One was that I got a 3-year consulting contract to work with the Imagineers to reduce it to practice. Two, I got to keep a few percentage points of it for royalties, which was wonderful. And the third thing was that they paid me enough money where I could say to my folks, hey guys, I think we're going to close the production company. And if you want to keep it going, you guys keep it going. But I'm going to go work at the Disney org as a consultant for a couple, 3 years and see what it's like to do like high-end technology for the television business and the advertising business, because it's really fascinating to me. And to be fair, I don't think I can do one more Chubbs baby wipes stackable boxes 30-second spot, an underscore for that, you know, while this is sitting out there. Like, there were things that were just pulling me to the not day-to-day. And I mean, our business was like thousands of on-air promos for the networks and for syndicated television. We did all the on-air promos for the Ricky Lake Show, for Judge Judy, Judge Joe Brown, Moesha in syndication, Seinfeld in syndication, Baywatch. Like, we had a massive promo business going on. We were doing, I don't know, a zillion radio commercials. I don't know how many jingles and underscores, more underscores than jingles, because jingles have sort of fallen out of favor by the late 90s. I mean, people weren't really singing about their stuff anymore. It's just about underscores. And they didn't pay as well as they used to, because the stock music business had gone from needle drops on vinyl records to CDs, which were all digital, to files. It was the nascent time where they were just starting to do, you know, files. that were, of course, sonically perfect. But much more importantly, you didn't need a musicologist anymore because there was a database you could search, and then you could listen very quickly to three, four things. The editors would buy these sound libraries. The client would fall in demo love. And rather than pay us 25 grand, they licensed a piece of needle drop that was now digital for 800 bucks and be done. Like, and I couldn't even argue with them. It's like, you know, somebody in Texas or in Nashville with no union residuals, like we were a full union shop. So it wasn't just what we were going to charge you as a creative fee in the production. You then had to pay the royalties, as opposed to you go to one of these production music libraries and you're done at 800 bucks. Like the disparity was too great. So our business was already sort of like boring, leveling off. It's not that we didn't have big projects. We did. And we had great projects. I'm not going to, you know, I did all the music for Spin City, for Michael J. Fox's show. I was writing ID campaigns for big networks as they launched MSNBC, Turner Network Television. Like we had good work, but it wasn't anywhere near as exciting as the Disney org coming over to you and saying, hey, you have a patent that sort of dictates the future of television. You want to build it? I was like, yes, that's why I patented the idea. So that sort of was the transition of my career.
What was the patent?
The patent teaches OCAP, the Open Cable Application Protocol. It basically turns cable networks with head ends and set-top boxes into client-server networks suitable for interactive communication.
Got it.
So it pretty much, and it's the earliest patent in the space, 93. So it was when it was invented. So it was valuable to Disney in that they wanted to do enhanced television. And they had, at the time, there was a really big push for some level of interactivity. Remember, this predates smartphones. And so people had desktops and laptops were really luggable back then. So the prevailing wisdom, with no mind paid to what was going on in the West Coast with respect to the evolution of glass phones and iPads and what have you and iPhones, you know, we were still in the world of flip phones.
Yeah.
When this was going down, brick, you know, Nokia bricks and StarTech flip phones were the rage during that time. Palm Pilot was the highest level of tech you could imagine, and that came later. So it was a different world, and everybody thought interactivity was going to be somehow connecting desktops and laptops to television. That was going to be interactivity. No one realized that the interactivity later would be you're laying on the couch with your phone in your hand, interacting with everything in the world but the TV.
Yeah, right.
And then ultimately that it would replace the television too. But at the time, you know, it's quaint to think back on it, and it seems like we didn't know what we were doing. But this was the cutting edge of both thought leadership and technological capability. Like, we were all the way on the edge, and we didn't know what we didn't know, and consumers hadn't demonstrated preferences yet because consumers hadn't had the technology long enough, and most of it didn't exist. Like, the things that exist today that are completely taken for granted just literally didn't exist, even in concept, back then.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back for a second because you mentioned the transition between jingles and needle drop libraries, basically.
Yeah.
And when it comes to AI music, there's two places where I see that really making a big impact in music. One is in mastering, which it's incredibly good at, but the second one is doing production music.
100%. I'm probably the most hated person at ASCAP now. I was asked by the hierarchy there to moderate at the annual meeting, their AI symposium at the annual ASCAP meeting. And I've been a pretty decent earner at ASCAP for most of my career. I mean, I love those guys. They're great. So, of course, I agreed. Got on the stage. People there are delusional about what this is. If you go to shellypalmer.com and scroll all the way to the bottom, because I don't really ever talk about it, there's a little link to original music. And if you scroll down that page, there are two styles demonstrations. One is MSNBC's original ID campaign, which has everything from a symphony orchestra to tabla and sitar statements of the theme. And the other is one of my favorite projects ever. It's about 7-8 arrangements of the Meow Mix jingle. And is one in Motown, and one in Baroque, and one in jazz, a scat. One is like doo-wop. Another one is in country. I have actually Charlie Daniels playing fiddle. It's amazing. Just all these different styles. And so how do you know what a musical style is? And the answer is, well, this is something you learn in school and also by listening. And if you're a musicologist, you can identify substyles. Oh, that's crunk. Oh, that's Southern Miami crunk. Oh, that's, you know, Fort Lauderdale crunk. I mean, you'll know, oh, that's hard bop. That's bebop. You know, that you learn, you know, music is pitch, meter, and rhythm, but you learn, like, okay, what are the timbral and orchestral devices used for a style of music? Rhythmically, where do you sit? Where does it sit on the, like, you just learn the rules. And you learn by listening, and ultimately you can identify different styles of music. Oh, that's neoclassical, that's neo-Baroque, that's actual Baroque, that's actual classical, that's symphonic, that's a studio, that's LA corporate rock and roll. Like, you know what these things are. And a lot of people know what they are. As a matter of fact, so many people know what they are that you can go to school for it. And B, there's pull-down menus that you can literally use when you're cataloging music to identify the macro genres and all of the subgenres. So you and I know that, and we know it well. And everybody in the ASCAP audience knew it too. And they were fine with that whole explanation until I said, so you know what another word for rules is? And everybody looks at me and I go, algorithms. And do you know which devices on earth are awesome at executing algorithms? And man, that was it. They were like throwing bananas and rotten tomatoes at the stage. It's like, I'm sorry, you think you're special, but if you've got a chase scene and the chase scene is 94 seconds long and there are three quick turns that happen at this frame, and this frame, and there's a crash that happens there. And they're like, and you've taken the counts on this 93 seconds and you're going to now find a tempo that works and you're going to like, you're going to find some driving thing that just really feels right. They're going to add sound effects and the gears changing and tires screeching and people screaming. And it's going to be like a cacophony of sound design. And then there's going to be some dialogue over it. Do you really think in your heart of hearts that you can't describe this piece of music to a diffusion model and have it make a, and tell it a genre, and it's not going to, I need this thing to have, I want a hip hop chase scene. I want an EDM chase scene. I want a John Williams-esque chase scene. I want to, it's going to do it. It's going to do it great. And it's going to do it for basically in near or at real time. So, you know, and it's going to do it for no or very low cost. And there's no way in the world that in the production business that we all live in, that certain kinds of graphics, interstitials, this new tool Sora from OpenAI, which does text to video, one of the things they show on their site is a what we would have called in the old days a West Cam shot. Now you do it by drone. It's a shot of the Pacific Palisades, a drone shot. It's happening at 4:35 o'clock on the West Coast, which is like the gloaming. The weather is perfect. The sunlight is perfect. So there's just the right amount of clouds to sort of filter the sunlight perfectly against this rocky shoreline. And this drone or helicopter with no shadow, of course, you know, which would have been impossible to shoot, by the way.
Yeah.
You'd either have to rotoscope it out or hope for the best, or you have a very skilled pilot, either for drone pilot or helicopter pilot. And they do this amazing shot. And it's like somebody described it. It doesn't matter if that took 30 seconds or 3 hours to make. You know what it didn't cost? 80 grand.
Yeah, right.
That's what that shot is to shoot. And if I'm the second unit director and I'm told, hey, go out and get me 10 interstitials of the Pacific Palisades for this segment of our whatever over 5 days, and I'm waiting for the sunset and I'm waiting for the weather, and I'm like, are you kidding me? There's no way in the world I'm not typing that in going forward. And it's the same thing with an underscore. If I have production music needs and it's like, I need a transition to get from scene A to scene B, make it sound like John Mayer met Taylor Swift at Willie Nelson's house. We're done. No one's going to identify that as anything except a semi-poppy piece of country, because that's what's going to come out. And it's going to, and very guitar heavy, and it's going to be done. And we're, and like anyone tells me different, doesn't understand the business I was in for 41 years, where they cut every cost they could cut in every way they could, unless it's a superstar. Like, they'd pay any money for Taylor, but if you needed to, like, they'd go license the Randy Newman song for $200,000 and then break your chops about adding an extra three fiddles because you didn't feel like overdubbing. That's the world I lived in.
Okay, you just hit on something. And what that is basic prompting.
This is one of the problems that I have with especially the text-to-video and text-to-image AIs that are out there, in that it expects you to really provide it with a detailed prompt, which, okay, no problem, as long as you know exactly what you want and you're good at explaining it. But most people are not, either one or the other. It's just like when you have somebody that, can't get the right question to ask. They know what they want, but they can't.
Let me just cut you off and say your problem is not a problem at all. It's a feature, not a bug. All of these tools are skills amplifiers. They are not skills democratizers. If you think these tools democratize anything, you are sadly, horrifyingly mistaken. If you are great, your productivity will increase exponentially. If you're good, you will see an increase in your capability. And capability is the wrong word, your productivity. If you suck, you will still suck. You are going to need taste and skill. You are going to need to know exactly what to ask. And you're going to need to not only expect the output, you're going to need to be able to evaluate the quality of the output in a way that a senior producer who is super famous and highly well paid and very successful would do it. Like, these tools will make people at my level and above, and there are plenty of people above my level, but my level and above, it's like, this is a skills amplifier that just makes you more productive. You bang shit out all day long. But if you are, I want to say this differently, actually. There is some magic here that's really spectacular. And it's a lived experience that I've had, and it's worth describing. While this, and I, again, adamantly, this is a skills amplifier, not a skills democratizer, but the consequence of that is pretty profound. Two things. One, whatever you think social media did to media, that's what social production is going to do to production. Meaning that people with no or low skill are going to be able to describe what they want and get it. And it will, you know, that's either fair or not fair, depending on who you are. Now, the consequence of that reality, the ability to describe something and get something, maybe not what I would get because I'm going to prompt it better, because I know what I'm asking for and I know precisely what I'm going for. And I even know how to add serendipity in there because I've always known how to do that, because you have to create with an open mind. You can't create with a closed mind unless you have a very specific reason to do that. When you're just creating, you try to keep your brains open. But here's the consequence that's going to be really fascinating. The best will become more productive and they will rejoice in these tools because they get time back in their day. And I have a lot of personal experience over the last 2 years of chat clients and conversational AI getting me back a lot of time in my day, and diffusion models getting me back a lot of time. I now am able to work approximately 13 months and 10 days for the 12-month year by measure. That's the productivity increase on just one area of my own career. But here's what's going to happen. The people with no skill whatsoever are going to froth up into a ton of content that is highly mediocre, but dramatically fulfilling to this group of people. Because if you have no skill and all of a sudden you've got some skill, you won't know that what this is garbage because you didn't know to begin with, or you won't know that it's not up to par. Maybe you will, but meanwhile, you will have done it and you will have some pride of authorship and you will have some ability, importantly, magically, to feel something and have someone else feel what you feel, which is the nature of media and music and video and all communication that we do by creating content. The victims of this consequence are every human being in the middle, semi-skilled human beings who've been phoning it in, imposters, people who just really aren't good at their job, but they've just been hired because they can do the job. All the people who are living in the middle are eliminated by this, because the people who are completely unskilled but have money or time or an idea don't need middle ground people. So there's no low end market to be catered to. The low end now takes care of itself, and the high end never needed these people to begin with. And so that middle group is the victim of this. We are we are years away from a skills democratizer. That doesn't mean people won't believe their skills have been democratized. This is not This is a non-trivial reality. People may think that their skills have been democratized and that there's now no reason to pay for fill in the blank. I can make a graphic for YouTube. I can make a graphic for my cover shot on my website. I can make a, by just asking for it, and it can just happen and it's good enough. Yeah, I think that's going to happen. So everybody that would have serviced that group with real jobs where you're calling the graphic artist, you're calling a composer, you're calling in a producer, you're going to a mastering engineer because you really need that signal path to be dead quiet. You want to sit in the room. Importantly, you want to listen to it on Bob Ludwig's, you know, system because, wow, I'm listening to Bob Ludwig's system. And this is, I want to be in Bob Clearmountain's room. I want to be in Alan Meyerson's room. Yeah. It's like, yeah, if you want to do that, sure. But basically, RX11 will take you there.
I'm with you completely. I think my point here that I didn't make was that I'm looking forward to a better interface because right now the interfaces are clunky for the most part, but it's just like all technology. It starts out crude and eventually it gets slicker as it goes along. And I think we're not at that stage yet where it's, and we'll speed things up as a result.
So look, you know, right now everything is a task. And none of the tooling is in place. We're going to end up in a world of autonomous agents where you set goals. You will set, I need a podcast that stars, you know, Bobby and Shelley, and go make it. And it will. But just make it. It'll have your voice clone and my voice clone, and it'll just do it. And the subject's going to be, I need to, you know, have Bobby and Shelley talk about AI for 20 minutes. Done. You know, that, and it won't ask you how, and it won't ask you what. It'll understand where it needs to go to get the information in the private data that you have, which would make it, you know, something that's unique and valuable, or on the public internet, which would make it less valuable and less unique because it would be an agglomeration of nonsense. But one way or the other, the interface, not only is it not complete, the tooling isn't done yet. If you can think about, like, in the late 90s, when people were starting to build websites and you had to put a login because you wanted to have some level. So everybody was writing their own login. You'd write your own functions. You'd put them in your own library. Then one day OAuth shows up and, you know, there's login with Google, login with Facebook. It's half a line of code. It's not even a full line of code. It's a half a line of code. And now your login is done. It's like that tooling is in place. And that equivalent in the world of AI does not yet exist. When it does, to your point, this is going to get a lot easier and very different. And by the way, what we don't know at all, nobody knows, at least not as of at 5:08 p.m. on March 5th, 2024, we don't know, what's Apple going to do?
Yeah, right. The big question.
I mean, you know, what's Amazon going to do with Alexa? What's Apple going to do with Siri? Because both of those tools have yet to be revised into even the OpenAI world, let alone what Apple could do with it. So, like, we're sitting here thinking, well, it's not mature. It's like, not mature. The biggest guys in the world have not yet told us what they're going to do. And you, if it's not the next iPhone, it's the one after it. Apple's not in any rush. I mean, look what happened to Google by rushing. You know, they've just stepped on their own feet like 50 times in a row now. Apple hasn't done that. They have the highest end users. They have the best technology in the world. They have the highest end hardware. And when they decide it's AI time, whatever that experience is going to dictate a lot of, like, how we do stuff.
Yeah.
You know, what does the interface look like? And by the way, they could also completely screw it up. There's Siri is a complete screw up, and they haven't fixed it in years. Like, it's been terrible since it launched. They keep saying it's improving, not to my mind. And I mean, I think it's terrible. It's still terrible. And, you know, Alexa's there to sell Amazon product and tell you the weather. I mean, you know, doesn't do anything else. Run some of the stuff in your house by voice. Right. It's very limited in its uses. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's limited in its uses. When Amazon gets that right, you're talking to your house and your house is talking back, and, you know, you're talking to the data that is generated by all of the different systems. And you're like, what a world that's going to be. And we don't know what that's going to look like. I have no idea what that's going
to
look like.
You know, it's funny because I was out to dinner with the head of Amazon Music. This is before before COVID. And he made a statement. He says, we own voice. And he was adamant about how they own voice. And he thought that this was their magic carrot. And in fact, that hasn't been so much so that they laid off everybody in that division. So it's not what they thought.
No. Well, look, they to their credit, what they did with Amazon Polly and with AWS Polly and all of their ASR tools, their automatic speech recognition tools, is they gave you as an engineer the ability to recognize, I'm going to use this, 97 point something percent of the words spoken. Now, that's not natural language understanding. It's automatic speech recognition. Big difference. What ChatGPT can do is it can understand what you're asking it and give you a response based on what you ask. Amazon can recognize the words you say, go to a table, look up the words, and get the best guess at what it is it thinks that table says you want. It's computing. It's not doing any of the other cool stuff. When Amazon decides to transform Alexa voice services into a modern automatic combination of automatic speech recognition and natural language understanding and natural language processing, all of a sudden we're going to have a new world. If they go there, they may not. I'm assuming they will, but only for competitive reasons, but they may have really good reasons business-wise not to do it. And look, I'm making the assumption that Apple, because of their immense brand association with privacy, with data privacy, will run a local large language model on your device so that it's yours, yours, and only yours. Or they'll, if it's in the cloud, they'll encrypt it. And they will, you will be so trustworthy of the fact that your data won't leave your phone that you'd be willing to use it as the kind of assistant you need. One of the problems with having a good assistant is that it needs to know more stuff than you'd let Google know, right? You just won't do it. It's like, here's my, I have to go to the doctor. Like, are you really going to let it do doctor's appointments for you if you thought for 1/1,000,000th of a second the insurance company could scrape that? Or like, you wouldn't do it, right? So all the things that have to happen to make this really valuable to you, Tim Cook has positioned himself pretty well to give you if they go there. And so that's my assumption with where they're going to take this. But again, complete, total speculation, could be total nonsense. Maybe they never get there.
Shelley, how did you get to be a television personality? How did that happen?
I don't know. I went to TV school. What can I tell you? I was in the Emmy organization for a long time, and I've done a zillion speeches about the intersection of technology, media, and entertainment. And I mean a zillion. Like I probably do 50 to 60 public speaking engagements a year, and have been doing so for the last 20 some odd years, more, 30 years. And so I've been approached by every television network, every radio show, everybody that covers the stuff that I care about to do segments. And you know, one thing led to another. My only steady TV gig is on Fox 5's New York, Fox 5 New York's on-air tech guy. But I do some commentating and some punditry on CNN and CNBC as well. But mostly I'm on Fox 5. And I go in and out of doing my own personal podcasts and videos. And, you know, when I'm bored, I do them. And when I get busy, I stop doing them because I'm too busy. I like it. You know, it's just.
Well, I follow you when you do it. I try to attend whenever the live ones happen. So, yeah.
Appreciate it. Yeah. No, look, we get good crowds when I do it. I won't say we don't. It's just, it's to do a good job is time consuming. And, you know, at the end of the day, like everybody thinks AI was invented on November 30th, 2022, which has been extremely good for me and my company. It's not true, of course. It's probably more like November 30th, 1943, when Perception, you know, we've just been so incredibly blessed with great clients and wonderful people that we work with. And we're at the right place at the right time with the right skills for the clients that we have. So it's been pretty nice. Look, you know, and an old teacher, and I was a really young, and had a bad day. And he gave me some good advice. He says, you know, when things are terrible, I wouldn't worry about it. When things are great, I wouldn't worry about it. And I looked at him and said, what? He says, they won't stay that way. You're going to be fine. So things are great right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm worried about it. Things, you know, things go up and down.
All right. I'm going to let you go in a second. But first, I hold my list, which is 50,000 people or so.
Nice.
And I asked them, what were their reservations about AI? And these are all musicians or recording engineers or music people. And two things came back. One was they were afraid they're going to lose their creativity. And the second thing was they're afraid that AI technology is moving so fast that whatever they learned about it today was going to be obsolete tomorrow.
Valid.
Well, to some degree. I mean, you know, historical things and basics are all, you know, you always have those.
So for the first fear, first of all, I have to say there are big feelings about this everywhere. And everyone is entitled to feel the way they feel. And that's not lip service and that's not me patronizing. I do a lot of seminars and a lot of workshops and a lot of speeches. And before you understand this tool set and its capabilities, current capabilities, and start thinking about it in the context of what you can do and how it actually works, abject fear is the state that you're in when you touch it for the first time. But after you use it, you realize that subject matter expertise and being human is a critical aspect. Again, these are skills amplifiers, not skills democratizers. So people who we train lose their fear of losing their job to the robots. They get a new fear, losing their job to someone who's better at robots than they are. Right. So that's first. With respect to losing your creativity, we have we are in grave danger of these tools promoting monoculturism at scale that we have not seen before. You know, you go down to the West Village and you walk through the various shops down there and you see one interesting merchant and an art gallery, and then someone's got like a little antique clothing store, and then someone's got some weird like gizmo gadget place. And each one is this reflection of the store owner's creativity and their curation, their ability to curate and their eye and the whole thing. And then you drive down Route 17 in Paramus, New Jersey, and every store looks exactly the same. You know, everything's got like a Parsons table that looks like an Apple Parsons table with like the stuff neatly laid out on it, the way Apple lays their stuff out. It's like, or it looks like IKEA, or it looks like there's like seven things that retail stores look like and about five things that fast food restaurants look like. And we're done. Like America's become generica. And any town you go into, you're going to see that group of stores that's going to look that way. And you forget that there are humans who are creative and brilliant and exude style and can make you feel a certain way just by the way they design the experience for you. When we start training models on the same exact stuff, and these are word calculators and diffusion models work very much the same. They work differently, but they give you the same kind of thing. Every image you see generated by Dolly looks like Dolly generated it. Yeah. You're never confused about what generated it. So monoculturism is the danger. Is it losing your creativity? No, it's losing the soul of individualism as we average things together. And the more synthetic data that gets created, the more it gets fed with its own data. Like if you gave it a few shot example of two Picassos, a Banksy and a Renoir, and said, mash this up, you're going to get something crazy and wild, but it's going to look like it did it. When you take three things it's done and say, hey, make a mashup of this, it's mashing up its own stuff. Now we're like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. And I think that's the real danger. Monoculturism is the danger. And I think every musician, every artist, every writer has to be really aware of what they're doing and how they're doing. I think you need to be present. And look, the kids will learn to use this in a different way than grownups who are new to the world. Like if you grow up in a world of pre-trained transformers, you're going to have it the same understanding of it that we had of television or of stereo systems that, you know, 50 yeah. years ago.
Yeah.
This is their world. If you're coming to this world new, like everybody is, it's a different vibe. And I think that your listeners and your audience is 100% right. It's not lose creativity. That's probably doesn't go far enough. It's way worse than that if you let it be. So, but you know what the problem is going to be. So I think you can guard against it. And look, these are as crazy as this is, it's still early days. And it is unclear how this plays out. I had a great question asked of me a couple of weeks ago. Really, really interesting. It's at a cocktail party. And a guy comes up to me and he kind of knows what he does. He says, hey, how do you think all of these AI models will impact the GDP? Like with all this productivity, you think we're going to see a lift in domestic GDP in the United States? I'm like, it's a really good question. I'm not qualified to answer in any way, but I doubt you're going to see it because this is not going to be a homogeneous productivity increase. This is going to be highly specialized. The people who need these tools know who they are and they will use them. And everybody else who's getting Copilot and Gemini and all the productivity tools that come with the Office suites, it's a level playing field. Everybody just upped their game a little bit. So yeah, you get more productive, but everybody gets more productive. And it's not where someone gets a competitive advantage, you're gonna build more wealth. It's just, this is how you do business now. No one's gonna get paid more for doing a better meeting summary.
Yeah,
they'll do a better meeting summary. The company may do better, but will you be able to measure that in the great wash of companies? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not qualified to make that calculation, but I don't see this as we wake up in a year and everybody's 20% more productive and the world is a better place. I don't see that at all.
You know, there's so much more I wanted to talk to you about, but I don't want to keep you too much longer. So this is the last question. It's something I ask of everybody. And I really wanted to go down the copyright hole with you because that's kind of interesting, but another time maybe.
Another time.
You may have answered this already, but let's throw it out. What's the best piece of advice that you've either received or you learned yourself along the way?
I will say it in the vernacular in which it was delivered to me. I will not tell you who delivered it because I do not want to rat them out. But it was the most important thing anyone ever said to me ever early in my career. Don't believe your own bullshit. Ever. Exclamation point. Those are words to live by. It's like, I was really young when that wisdom was imparted to me by an individual who I had immense respect for, not my parents, another guy. And the circumstances were humbling, and I've never forgotten it. I think that's the best single sentence advice I've ever, ever, ever received. And I have tried really, really, really hard to let my inner circle know that just because I said it doesn't mean it's real. And no matter how many, you know, that was awesomes I get from clients, I still want the notes. I still want to hear from my team. How many ums did I say? Where did I not communicate clearly? What did I do wrong? Give me the notes on the speech. And I want them honestly. Like you can't get caught up in your own stuff, man. It's like, you gotta practice every day. Sit down, play your scales and chords every day, play your arpeggios every day. Get your practice calendar out. And today's broken thirds and diminished chords, go. There is a second piece of advice you just made me think of. That came from Don, may he rest in peace. This is so ridiculous. So I have this job that we're going to do. It doesn't matter what the client was. And I made the demo, and Don was at Club Med with his family, like playing like for free. He played for free. So they gave him like a vacation for like 5 days because he would like play with his jazz combo. And then like he came back all tan and happy and whatever. And I was working on this job while he was gone. And so I've done the demo, and I'm about to press play for him. I said, okay, look, you know, this is like just like a little piano voice thing. And I just, you know, I got a couple of, but you know, it's, and I'm just kind of setting it up. So I'm trying to manage expectations. And Don puts his hand up and says, stop. Never apologize in advance. You'll have so much time afterwards. You just made me think, like,
yeah,
you know, of all the things I ever heard ever, that actually was just as good as don't believe your own bullshit. Only it was probably more important in the overall scheme of my, you know, later career. Because I learned to say, hey, I made this thing for you. And you press play. And then you watch and see if they tap their toes. And if they do, you got it sold. And if they just go, that's interesting, you know, you're screwed. Like that was... That was the entire music business from Don and like one nugget, you know.
You can find out more about Shelley and learn about AI from his Meta Academy at ShelleyPalmer.com. That's Shelley Palmer, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOsinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music news, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at BobbyOsinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's BobbyOsinski.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.